Tonight from Hollywood, we bring you a star, Mr. Orson Welles.
This is a moviola.
It's a machine for editing film. But, you know, when we say that we're editing or cutting a film, we aren't really saying enough.
What? No. Movies cut. Hang on. Stop it. Sorry to interrupt before we really got going. Orson Welles, he's right. We definitely don't say enough when we talk about editing. It's actually like a dirty little secret. But Martin, I thought we were going to start with that clip of Walter Murch, and we can come back to Orson Welles later on. Let's start with us arriving at Walter Murch's editing room.
Walter?
Yeah, hello?
Walter?
Yes. Hi, Mike. How are you? Pleasure.
Walter, thank you for agreeing to talk to us today. And I wanted to start off with just a banal question, which is, how do you feel about us editing you? Which is inevitably what's going to happen.
I would say, please edit me. I will go off on tangents and scurry down rabbit holes, but it's your responsibility to prune all of this back to make it seem more coherent than it probably really is.
The subject of editing, when you start thinking about it, is almost infinite. Ever since we've had, let's say, cognitive thinking, we have immediately begun editing.
Close to the edit, part one. Please edit me.
I would say, please edit me. I would say, please come in and then leave at 7 o'clock at night. I would say, please show these to her and then explain to me what's happening.
What is happening? I have a creeping sense that edits are everywhere these days. It's like we're living in the age of the edit. Cutting, pasting, cropping.
Cutting,
collaging.
Pasting, cropping, collaging.
The idea of editing is nothing new. It's the raw material of human memory and imagination. It's what our dreams are made of. And it's hard to conceive of narrative without the edit. But something changed with the advent of edited film at the turn of the 20th century. The first ever edited moving film is said to be Come Along, Do, made by Robert W. Paul in 1898. You can find the remains of it on the internet. A flickering scene shows a couple on a bench outside an art gallery. Should they go inside? And suddenly the scene changes, and there they are, inside, admiring the artworks. A simple jump in time and space, but that first filmic cut opened a door, ushering in a century of the edit. Okay, let's get back to Orson Welles now. For him, editing was the key thing.
Movies aren't just made on the set. A lot of the actual making happens right here. So a moviola like this is very nearly as important as a camera. Carlyle said that almost everything examined deeply enough will turn out to be musical. Of course, this is profoundly true of motion pictures. The pictures have movement. Movies move, and then there's the movement from one picture to another. There's a rhythmic structuring to that. There's counterpoint, harmony, and dissonance. A film is never right until it's right musically. And this moviola, this filmmaker's tool, is a kind of musical instrument. It's here that other film instruments are tuned and finally orchestrated. So if you find me winding up our conversation here, you understand that as a filmmaker, I'm speaking to you from my home.
For Orson Welles, the edit was in the service of the film. It made the film happen. But as we open our ears to a century of editing, I want to isolate the edit as a thing in itself.
What are we doing when we edit, and what is it doing to us? Because edits are all around us, hiding in plain sight. It's a constant intervention in our cultural lives, films, music, literature, journalism, the digital world, even our very DNA. They're all subject to the hidden hand of the editor. So, can we edit that disparate history into one neat archive on four? Can we trace a route from that very first cinematic splice to the thousands of edits that have gone into this very program?
It seems, and I would emphasize seems, that when you wake up in the morning, you remove...
Okay, first things first. The BBC want us to tweet a soundbite. Par for the course these days. Part marketing, part zeitgeist. So we've cropped and filtered an image and combined it with an edited soundbite from this program, and we've sent it out into the world to mingle in the stew of all the other fragmentary messages and mashed-up images.
The soundbite wasn't invented by Twitter.
Margie Borsky is a writer and academic. She's based in Sydney, Australia, and she's the author of the book This Is Not a Remix.
We've been complaining about soundbite culture since the 1980s at least. But what happens now is the soundbite isn't just this thing in a television program or a radio program that then you never access again, right? So what happens is that the BBC tweets its short soundbite, and then it has this new kind of life. It's detached from its mothership.
The reality is that we're dealing with fragmented images every moment of our waking life.
One thing that can be is a kind of marketing, but it might also be the only thing that the person consumes. You know, it might work. It might do something for them. Quotes can be very effective. And this is where, you know, we can sort of talk about how music kind of works that way, how samples can kind of come into their own. They might be from a particular recording, but once liberated, there's something new, even though they're exactly the same.
Mankind has been seeking knowledge of everything that influences his own life or the life of the nation to which he belongs.
This is a film about the events in Iran in 1953, where the CIA...
Walter Murch is a bit of a legend and a personal hero of mine. And he's worked closely with Francis Ford Coppola for over 50 years on films like The Conversation, one of my favorites, The Godfather, and Apocalypse Now. He's a polymath, as curious about sound as images, and he's working in London at the moment on a new documentary about the coup in Iran in 1953.
I'm assembling the first cut of the film, and we're about a quarter of the way through, I would say. Also, interestingly, we're involving some aspect of the process of making this film. How do you make a film like this? So you see the editing room and you see some of the shooting going on and discovering archive stuff, discovering old quarter-inch tapes of speeches and things.
Could you just play a little of this into the room so I could record just to run underneath?
I mean, 25 years ago, you would have had a lot of people physically handling both film and sprocketed sound tape and so on and so
yes.
forth. There would be many, many rooms. How many people do you have now, Walter?
It was me and the director, Taghi, and an associate editor, basically three people. The last time I tallied it up, we had 356 hours of material. So just keeping your mitts on all of that material would have been a full-time job for probably a dozen people if we were making this back 25, 30 years ago.
Great, thank you.
Yep, digital technology has changed the way Walter Murch works. It's definitely changed the way I work, and it's probably changed the way you work and live, the way you spend your time and the things you consume. It underpins the ubiquity of editing in our lives today.
Eisenstein, probably the greatest theoretician in cinema, as well as one of its greatest directors.
Herbert Marshall translated the writings of Soviet filmmaker Sergei Eisenstein, and here he is in 1973, remembering Eisenstein's lectures in London in the late 1920s, Already, Eisenstein was seeing that humans have always sought to construct edited versions of the world they live in.
He pointed out that in the earliest paintings, frescoes, bas-reliefs, they are really nothing but an extended cinematographic montage in their appropriate form, so that if you looked at Chartres and went around the outside, you would be able to see all the life of the apostles and of Christianity and so on there shown in cinematic form. If you went to China 1,000 years ago, a high-ranking mandarin at a party would take out a scroll and he would unroll in front of you the whole history of his family, you know, unroll it like a cinema film. If you look at Hadrian's Column in Rome, you will see that there is literally a film strip wound around the column right to the top with all the campaigns of the emperor on it.
Edits are what radio programmed. Edits are what radio programs. Edits are what radio programs like this are made of. Every sound clip that you hear has been cut, trimmed, adjusted, cut and trimmed, slightly changed,
yeah,
trimmed, cut, or trimmed, or adjusted. And to get at this scattered subject, we're going to split this program into separate sections and recombine them, a collage of our own, 6 edits in no particular order. And this is the end of the first section. Now, I've recorded that. I'm going to record the beginning of section 2, but you won't hear that just yet. I'm going to make an edit before then and insert something else.
There's a great quote from Mr. Fleming, the director of Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz, who said, "Good editing makes the film look like it was well directed. Great editing, whatever that means, makes it look like the film wasn't directed at all," meaning it's just happening, that the audience is simply in the moment and unaware of the subterfuge that is creating that moment.
In montage, always choose pieces which do not fit.
You take a sound, any sound, record it.
How do I feel, you know?
And then change its nature.
I
love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Where does the news come from? Who decides what shall be put in and what shall be left out?
Wonderful, 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 wonderful.
It really should be called assembly.
Close to the edit, part 2. It really should be called assembly.
It really should be the size of a brass instrument. It really should be jumping way, way high. It really should be the size of a nude woman.
The worry when you're being interviewed is that you're going to say something and it might be taken out of context. But that's also the hope,
taken out of context,
that you'll say something and it'll be taken out of context but make you sound smart instead of all those ums and ahs and all that sort of stuff that you were mentioning that you would kindly get rid of.
We call it cutting. It isn't exactly that. Cutting implies severing something. It really should be called assembly. Of course, the most elementary form is the juxtaposition of...
What was our world like 15,000 years ago?
Imagery.
What was it like any time before the end of the 19th century? We can imagine, but never really know. The camera changed all that.
The beginning of the 20th century was the almost the simultaneous invention of quantum mechanics and physics and film. And both of them cut reality up into pieces. And so we were experiencing, at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of this 20th century, this realization that what we think of as continuous reality is in fact chopped up into little bits.
Okay, I think we should really edit in another voice here just to break it up. So let's splice in the writer Will Self, and then we can cut between clips of Walter Murch and Will Self. Do that for a while, since they both spoke about how our brains do a fair bit of editing on their own, and we're just as oblivious to that as we are to the film editor's cuts.
The rise of the edit in the last 120 years is in a large part a function of the creation of narrative media that are visual and that are continuous, and particularly to do with film and proto-film forms like the zoetrope.
This Victorian toy, the zoetrope, was invented in the 1860s but mainly marketed towards the end of the 19th century. And you'll see here some more examples of the sort of strips that were used in the zoetrope. They were usually comic subjects, sometimes rather unpleasant. This one here, the person here with the mechanical fork, looks very unpleasant.
There's a fascinating essay by Oliver Sacks, the neurologist and thinker on matters neuroscientific, called In the River of Time. And Sacks makes the point that there is an uncanny correspondence between the rate at which our brain processes the still images we put together to create our sense of full motion and film. And the zoetrope, all depend on us viewing 22 frames a second and then placing them into a sequence.
It seems, and I would emphasize seems, that when you wake up in the morning, you remove the lens cap of sleep, and the next 16 hours or so are one continuous dolly shot interrupted by a few blinks, and then at night you put the lens cap on and go to sleep. If that was true, it could have been that we decided to experiment with cutting film from one shot to another, and we invited an audience in, and we ran edited film, and they all got seasick and threw up. And after that experience, we would say, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, we're doing something very strange to people. But just the opposite happens. And I think what that tells us is that, in fact, we do live already in an edited world. Vision itself is cut up into pieces, and we neurologically knit it together so that it seems continuous, but in fact, the reality is that we're dealing with fragmented images every moment of our waking life.
You can view induction, the main method by which we pilot our way through the world, as being a narrative sequence or the anticipation of a narrative sequence. So induction is the idea the sun will rise tomorrow because it's risen every preceding day. But assuming induction is assuming a continuous narrative process that is unedited, which in turn implies the idea of a potentially editable sequence. So I think all of that hyper-consciousness of the edit does come in the 19th century and comes in with the zoetrope.
In montage, always choose pieces which do not fit.
Now, they say the camera never lies. That is, of course, unless the photos have been airbrushed. Well, thanks to digital trickery.
Because there's nothing that I detest more than the stench of lies.
Close to the Edit, Part 3. I don't know about you, but my life's always happening now.
I don't know about you, but my life's always happening now. I don't know about you, but my life's always happening tomorrow. I don't know about you, but my life's always happening. Under the influence of very powerful LSD.
Some of the films, for example, that you make with Francis Ford Coppola, there are incredibly complicated visual and sound editing sequences in those films, which one can imagine doing fairly comfortably now on digital equipment, but That must have been incredibly complicated.
You had to keep more things open in your mind because you couldn't immediately see what you were doing. When I was editing the opening of Apocalypse Now, I had a chem editing table which had three screens, but all of the super, I couldn't see all of the superimpositions, so I had to look at the three screens simultaneously and imagine what one screen dissolving into the other would look like.
What about soundtracks?
And I had for that one soundtrack, which was just the music.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
I mean, we're standing next to your editing console, which is unique.
Yes, this is an architect's table that I bought when I was editing English Patient, which is now 20 plus years ago. And I've just carried it around with me wherever I go. The key is standing, and I mean, I have this idea that film editing, which is not really editing, it's the Romance language word montage is much better for it. Montage simply means to build or to construct, and that's what I'm doing now, is I'm constructing this film. I think it's better when you're standing to do these things, because it's like a weird combination of cooking and orchestra conducting and brain surgery, all of which people stand to do, because the time component in each of those is very important.
Just this week, Colm Tobin, the Irish writer, was saying that contemporary fiction is plagued by the flashback, which is, of course, in a sense, an edit, the interpolation of a past scene.
The rise of the edit. The rise of the rise of the edit in the last 120 years is in a large...
And Tobin was saying, if you go back to Jane Austen... So if you like a pre-Zoetrope writer, there's very little backstory for any of the characters. The action is impelled forward. And you might argue this is a pre-lapsarian, pre-edit age showing itself in narrative construction.
This is BBC Radio 4. And now here's Front Row with Kirsty Lang.
Hello tonight. The music you don't want to hear on a beach holiday. Steven Spielberg's seminal film Jaws was one of the inspirations behind Will Self's latest novel. Cinema also, I think, influenced the way you've written it.
You know, it's the old kind of sawhorse about Joyce opening the first cinema in Dublin and, you know, the impact of film and radio, I think, and all of these new media in the early 20th century on fiction.
They took it asunder, I heard them say, when will they reassemble it? Oh, my back, my back, my back. I'd want to go to Aixley Pains. Ping, pang, there's the bell for 6 o'clock.
You know, I'm teaching Ulysses at the university where I work next year, so I've been looking at it again, and frankly, you know, he was way out ahead of me in terms of incorporating filmic editing technique into the novel, using montage, match cuts, jump cuts. All of that is actually in Ulysses.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
You've got no paragraphs, no chapter breaks or headings, none of the usual furniture that we've come to expect from a novel. I mean, why do you think that a story is better told with this method?
It always strikes people as odd, but it's actually to do with naturalism. You know, there aren't chapters in life. Life doesn't take place in the simple past. You know, it's not like Kirsty and Will were on Front Row. We are on Front Row right now. It's all happening now. I don't know about you, but my life's always happening now.
In montage, always choose pieces which do not fit.
Who's got the story?
I don't even know if it's true.
What difference does it make if it's true? It's a story and it breaks. They're going to have to run with it.
Now, how do you feel about sound effects and background music? Are they essential components in achieving a powerfully realistic atmosphere on radio, or are they an infernal nuisance, interrupting and sometimes smothering the work?
Close to the Edit, Part 4. How do you feel about sound effects and background music?
Now, how do you feel about the shortage of children's whiskers? Now, how do you feel about the word howl? Now, how do you feel about drowning cats?
Enough of all this cutting. Is there not a virtue in not editing sometimes? In leaving things alone? Leaving things to speak for themselves? But it's anathema to a radio program like this. Whether the listener realizes it or not, every interview here has been pruned and edited, not just to remove the fluffs and the stumbles, but to sharpen it up or contract the meaning. It's a documentary of sorts, but it's not real.
Just this week.
Okay, take this clip of Will Self. You heard it a moment ago.
Colm Tobin, the Irish writer, was saying that contemporary fiction is plagued by the flashback, which is, of course, in a sense, an edit, the interpolation of a pause.
It's not quite what he actually said.
It's interesting. And I noted that just this week in a little flurry at the Hay Literary Festival, Colm Tobin, the Irish writer, was saying that contemporary fiction is plagued by the flashback, which is, of course, in a sense, an edit.
So is this what we mean when we talk about the lie that tells the truth?
There is subterfuge going on. We are doing a magic trick that deceives the audience, to both to entertain them and to, hopefully, if we are responsible people, which we all hope to be, that we're using that to get more efficiently at a deeper truth.
Okay, for the next 10 minutes or so, we're going to do away with editing. No fancy stuff, nothing spliced, no layers, no juxtaposition, no music underneath it. And let's ask the question, is this more like the truth?
I was just reading a book by Arthur Koestler a couple of days ago, and he was talking about that very thing.
Yeah. Also, I'm sorry, could I ask that you sit over
sure.
here just so that then the microphones
separate.
Will be facing you, yeah. Sure. So we're set up, if you can come in just a little bit as is comfortable.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Maybe if you kind of wave a hand if we get off the road and we need to specify what it is that we're talking about.
Are you running? Okay, Walter, you know, in no particular order, you have a lot of experience, both with a large number of directors that you've worked with, also with the technology itself, and you're kind of a renaissance editor in the sense that you don't limit yourself to the picture. You're as fascinated by sound, I would say probably even more so than picture. What is your ideal relationship with collaboration with a director?
The way it usually works, which is about as perfect as it can be, is that the director gives me a sense of where the project is going stylistically. If it's a dramatic feature, I've absorbed whatever I can from the screenplay and also from reading any research materials that the author might have done, for instance, on English Patient. I read some of the background material on that. So I try to steep myself as deeply as possible in the subject matter. And then during shooting, I am assembling the material as it gets shot. I'm like the person at the end of the parade cleaning up as the parade goes by. And the idea is that a week or so after the end of shooting, I have finished assembling a rough version, a complete version of whatever got shot. And then the director comes in and stays working with me more or less, depending on the schedule of the director. But during that assembly, I don't have very much to do with the director on a daily basis. I am obliged, both by my own morality, to say if I see some problem that really needs fixing, then I will go to the director and say, I think you need another shot here, or I wonder about that performance. It seems to be going in a strange direction. Maybe explain to me what's happening.
Mm-hmm. You do that.
Yeah. But I try, keep that to a minimum and after that period, during the post-production period, if I'm working with Francis Coppola, he will come into the editing room for a day or two at a time and then say, here's my ideas, and then he will go away for a couple of weeks. And I will continue with those ideas and finding out new ideas, which he encourages. And then he likes to be surprised. So when he comes back 2 weeks later, there's a new thing for him to look at. Contrast that with Catherine Bigelow, who on K-19, on first day of post-production, she moved into the editing room, set up her office on the sofa in the editing room, and that was where she stayed for the rest of the work. Although I would say she did leave at 7 o'clock at night, and then I continued to work for another 3 hours with ideas that had been spurred by what we had done during the day. And in the morning, I would show these to her and say, Catherine, when I came in this morning, the mice have nibbled away at the film, and maybe we better look at it. And so this is my code for, I've done some things. Let's look at it.
I mean, you kindly showed us what you're working on at the moment, and we watched, I think, a clip for several minutes, and I noticed that it already had very sophisticated mix and very powerful music, and I was immediately drawn to what, in fact, was, I would assume, is a series of archive shots that you've put together.
Right. Yeah.
But you already created a kind of a tension there. Now, digital equipment allows you to do that, which 25 years ago, that I don't think would have been possible.
That's correct.
And you were one of the first people to embrace the idea of the digital. I think you were the first person to use Final Cut and on a feature film and so on. When I say embrace, I'm sure with happiness, right? I mean,
yes. Yeah, no, I actually, the first time I saw a digital editing system was in 1968 in Los Angeles. It was actually the first time I met Francis Coppola. I was working as an editor at a commercial house, editing commercials, and George Lucas, who was a friend from school, came by, and he brought Francis Coppola with him, and they said, Walter, let's go up the street to look at this CMX system. And so we wandered up Seward Street in Los Angeles for a couple of blocks, and there was a early digital editing system. And I was very impressed with it, excited about it, and we left thinking, this is the future, and it will be here in 5 years. We were off by probably 15 or 20 years, because there were still huge technical limitations. This system could only deal with 5 minutes of material at a time, and it was in black and white, and the screen was very small and very degraded. But we all, three of us, saw this is it. And it actually, I remember putting together a proposal, Francis and I, for how to edit The Godfather on a digital system. It intoxicated us, and we embraced it wholeheartedly when it arrived. I'm very happy that I went through the apprenticeship of working with physical film, because it teaches you a discipline that you have to have, I think, to do this work, and it teaches you in a very unforgiving way. Apocalypse Now had
cancel. I've actually got it on mute. One sec.
Okay. The Apocalypse Now had 236 hours, which is 7 tons of 35 millimeter film. And yet you have to find, in those 7 tons, you have to find a single frame which weighs a few grams. And how to do that logistically is a challenge. That kind of work has been taken over by the computer, but it really just opens up other challenges. Now, on a film like this, I am designing visual effects, and I'm editing the music and selecting the music and editing sound effects and dialogue and everything. So it's the Lord taketh and the Lord giveth away, so to speak.
Yeah. Good. I think we should pause there.
Thank you.
In montage, always choose pieces which do not fit.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the celebrity TV quiz, Shooting Stars.
Back in the early 2000s, when I was still sustaining a career in light comedy and worked with Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer on Shooting Stars, it was shot as live as an hour on a soundstage at the old television centre. And not to be mean to Vic and Bob, but they're professional comedians. They always must have been there in the control room with the editor chopping all my best gags.
Close to the Edit, part 4. Sorry, no. It's part 5, isn't it? Part 5. Unifying fragments.
You're unifying fragments. You're playing with history. You're being boring. You're in the middle of a rectangular space in jiffy bags.
Is a sample and a recording the same thing? So are you sampling me now? So is every time we record something, is it a kind of sample? Or are we going to just use sample when we talk about something that uses a sampler?
A.J.P. Taylor, the famous historian, once said that all the things that were written about the causes of the First and the Second World War were done by historians who are engaged in the process of, you know, kind of almost like inventing narrative. He said the truth is, it's much simpler, it was the mood of those nations at that time to do those things. That, for most of us, is unacceptable. We don't want to deal with it was the mood of a nation to do appalling things to each other, because it makes our perspective of the world very, very scary, i.e. that could happen at any time. The mood of the nation could shift again. We haven't learned anything, and awful things can happen.
Bitte dön auf 42-4-0.
Erlkönig.
Ich verbitte mir das!
It has been said that the fragments of modernism were a response to a world that couldn't be knitted back together again after the First World War. And the German filmmaker Walter Ruttmann served in that war, and the films and sound pieces he made in the years afterwards certainly reflect a kind of fragmentation, like this one, Weekend, a portrait of a weekend in sound made for German radio in 1930. It's like a remix of the real world.
Hallo.
We're over halfway through this programme now, and some very clever editing is going to have to come into play to fit into our time slot.
When I was around 9 or 10, I had fallen in love with the first tape recorders that were just beginning to be available to the consumer market. I immediately understood that this tape could be cut and rearranged and pasted or taped back together again in a different order, that you could turn things upside down, that you could record something at one speed and play it back at another. And the more I got into that, the more involving it became. So this was 1953, 54. And I came home from school one day, turned on the radio, which was my usual thing while I did my homework, and they happened to be in the middle of playing something that sounded exactly like something I'd recorded myself a couple of weeks ago. It was strange sounds organized in a musical fashion. What I later learned was this French school of music called musique concrète.
At the beginning of the 20th century, montage showed us the power of the edit to create stories. Musique concrète
shows us something else, that the edit could be the story itself. This was the gateway to a dizzying rise in the power of the edit across many different cultural pursuits. And from then on, the content, the story, the music, the pictures, were just the means by which we could best experience the power of the edit.
There's definitely a secret history of the edit out there. When we talk about remix, we tend to talk about the introduction of the sampler, but there were all these ways that people kind of drew attention to things and edited things prior to those kinds of technologies.
Take this piece of music, for instance. One of the forerunners of the club remix scene in the 1970s. It's made for the dance floor and it's constructed from tape pause edits, literally from the clever use of the pause button on a tape recorder.
A lot of the ways that we edit on screen are still shaped by the ways that we edited with, you know, tape or cutting or cut and paste, you know, all these things. All the metaphors are shaped by a kind of analog past. Remember how much of our editing culture, if you will, is still shaped by pens and pencils and celluloid and tape and vinyl and acetate. All these things that we're already editable.
I start off by making these ideas, little ideas, mind maps.
Vicky Bennett is a collage artist, and she works with sound as well as still and moving images under the name People Like Us. Her instrument is the edit, and she combines and collides different elements to create a new experience, a new story.
Good grief!
Linda?
That's a bit of a monster.
Oh, I didn't recognise you under that cape.
I see what I do as part of folk culture, using the materials that are immediately available to you at no or low budget. And so in my particular case, in the late 1980s, I was using hi-fi-based material, so stuff from the living room, which was basically a double cassette deck, record decks, and radio tuner.
Now, I'd be ready to turn your radio down if I were you.
Good grief!
That's just about
I mean, it starts at one point, and then It doesn't carry on in a logical order, and then you've come back in where you started.
Wow.
Everybody's tense.
Very strong forehand topspin.
If you were making a patchwork quilt, you'd have all these different bits of material, and then you put it next to something that you felt it had a resonance with.
Somebody's heard something.
So you're making a flow of things which are unified, but they're actually fragments. You're unifying fragments.
It's a telling phrase, unifying fragments, because that's what we're doing here, the fragments of this program. But it's not the whole story. The editor is also excluding, concealing as much as revealing, and, by the way, muddying the waters of authorship as well.
The bass player joined in, he got a rhythm going, and guitar player Jimmy Nolan came in and started doing his thing, and Brown heard it and put the horns with it, and there you go, the funky drummer. Next thing I know, they're telling me, the samplers, the hip-hoppers, has got that drum pattern and running away with it on all their hip-hop songs. I went, what?
In my lifetime, I haven't really heard a lot of commercial recordings, I guess apart from live recordings, that were not constructions. And I don't see something wrong with that. I think it's made some really beautiful records. But then we have within that these concerns with sort of who gets to do the cutting and what happens when people start kind of recording things and cutting them up themselves and then actually re-releasing them.
Our experience of media is seen always to be the end point when it gets published. And then there's this unspoken assumption, and often spoken assumption, that when something is published, that is the end point and that no one must touch it. I think a really important thing about people who work with this is they're unravelling that. They're not unravelling it backwards, they're unravelling it forwards. Because there should be no end point for the conversation. Just because something gets published, it doesn't mean that that's the end of it. It doesn't mean that it's dead. I think it's creatively anarchic to take published material and say, no, we're reopening the case. You know, it's like Sherlock.
I do that in Adobe Premiere, so I do a sort of linear editing.
Vicky Bennett screened a fragment of her latest work for us, and it's an epic film called Gone, Gone Beyond, currently on show in San Francisco. It painstakingly weaves together the scenes and sounds of a multitude of films, finding points of comparison and points of departure.
It mixes together Apocalypse Now and The Sound of Music, which was inspired by the intro of the aerial view of The Sound of Music looking like the napalm exploding over the trees in Apocalypse Now. So visually you're seeing Julie Andrews walking along in the hills of Salzburg, and in the background everything's just exploding and helicopters are flying over. It's a 3D environment, so it's edited where people sit in the middle and then things happen all around the room. My heart wants to sing
every song. Apocalypse Now was a notoriously difficult film to make, and Walter Murch was the editor. He laboured for years constructing the film. And I wanted to know how you felt about the work being appropriated and collaged in this way.
I'm very sanguine about it. The film I'm working on right now is a historical documentary that uses archival material, and I'm making exactly that out of the film. It's a collage of films that were shot at different times for different purposes, and I'm repurposing them to help to tell the story that we're telling.
As we are with this radio program, framing clips, layering, weaving them together, bending the truth to tell a story about the edit.
Now we have a close-up. Let me show what he sees. Let's assume he saw a woman holding a baby in her arms. Now we cut back to his reaction to what he sees. And he smiles. Now what is he as a character? He's a kindly man. He's sympathetic. Now, let's take the middle piece of film away, the woman with the child, but leave his two pieces of film as they were. Now we'll put in a piece of film of a girl in a bikini. He looks, girl in a bikini, he smiles. What is he now? The dirty old man. He's no longer the benign gentleman who loves babies.
Who can remember when and then before then?
Post-truth. The news is fake.
He looks no older than 33.
Because so much of the news is fake.
And folks wonder what his secret can be.
She agreed to have her pictures enhanced.
2 + 2 = 5.
That is all you have to say.
Legs look longer, tummies flatter, cheekbones are higher.
Thank God for Google.
I'm telling you.
Thank God for Google.
The University of Google is where I got my degree from.
But with a merry doodle-loodle, every agent can skidoodles right away.
Close to the Edit, Part 6. How will we know if it's real?
how can we trust our media? You know, how will we know if it's real? How will we know the kind of anxieties of other people? How will we focus on understanding the past? How will we distract ourselves from the flying saucer?
The more we examine what we might call montage or editing, the deeper it seems to go into the culture in all kinds of unexpected ways.
I hold on to the embryo using some of these small forceps.
One of my colleagues at the University of Manchester is about to modify a frog embryo using a new and powerful technique that will transform science, medicine, and perhaps the human race and the whole planet. This is the gene editing technology known by the acronym CRISPR.
I think we are in an age of edit, and we're in an age of edit that is determined very, very powerfully by visual media of one kind. Now, they may incorporate digitized text to some extent, but really people are very fixated on images. They're very fixated on the way images are edited together. They're very fixated on the kind of truths or falsities they believe they extract from those edits.
In the age of the edit, the idea of the remix has shifted from referring to just music into a way of describing the way we live now, remix culture. Margie Borschke.
What we mean generally when we talk about remix culture now is a networked culture. One of its chief characteristics is that a lot of media expressions are made of other media. So it's a kind of media made from media. So if I take a video from YouTube and I put a different song over top of it, we could call that a remix. So a meme could be a remix, an image with words over it, right? And then we get to more sophisticated things where we're actually cutting things up and really kind of remaking them. And one of the things about digital media is that it's all made of the same thing. It's all electricity. It's all those zeros and ones. And so it is easily manipulated.
You know, I kind of go back in my own mind to a famous cinema advert for The Guardian, I think about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, which showed a man running.
An event seen from one point of view gives one impression.
The police officer's chasing after him in the first set of images, then it pulls back and you see that the guy is one of the police and they're chasing another guy.
Seen from another point of view, it gives quite a different impression.
It was calling our attention to the idea that we're being manipulated by edits of various kinds.
But it's only when you get the whole picture you can fully understand what's going on.
And The Guardian was setting itself up as a kind of honest, in a way, if you like, non-editor, somebody who's prepared to present information non-messed about with in the sequence at which it arrives, you know, kind of, as it were, what the intelligence services would call raw product.
I saw a few months ago this device that now you can have somebody talking on a screen, and you can control their facial movements by your facial movements in live time, so that I could make Donald Trump say something he didn't say in real time by me saying it with my lips. And there's software now being developed that will take my voice and turn it into Donald Trump's voice. So, you know, if we have those two things, then we can look at a shot with no cuts in it, and there's Donald Trump, and he's talking, and he's saying something in his own voice that he never said. Where do we go from there?
I think the power of the editor is enormous, and for that reason, traditionally, the editor has stood as a gatekeeper as well. The editing function and the curatorial function have walked hand in hand because there is an intuitive understanding of this problem with the capacity to edit data generated in that way. And as we've seen with numerous controversies in relation to social media sites, in relation to them functioning, as it were, as news sites in the last year or two and longer, there's a lot of anxiety that the editing function has been not only detached from the curatorial function, but neither of them seem to be effectively operating.
So, am I the only person who finds it difficult to navigate through the ocean of digital misinformation and sometimes information. I mean, we've had a century of the edit. Where are we? What's it shown us? Originally, the edit was there to move the story along. Orson Welles enchanted us with it, as legions of filmmakers, musicians, and YouTubers have done ever since. And we all love a good story. But sometimes the edit wins hearts and minds at the expense of truth. And we need to reflect on this, because if the century of the edit has told us anything, it's that any story we're told is rarely the story as it happened. It's been edited. So don't just enjoy the show. Ask a question. What is on the cutting room floor?
Look at Orion.
I occasionally make little films on my iPhone and upload them direct to YouTube. Of course, I don't even bother to edit them. I try and do them in a single live take. There's one on YouTube called Will Self's Alley, which is the alley near my house, where I've just walked along it, filming in real time all the rubbish.
It's astonishing when you really get into it now. The question is whether the phone will hear it.
And I suppose, in a way, that's my comment on the failure of editing and the failure of the curatorial function in the modern digital media context. However, I think we can't do without it, ultimately. If you like, the function of the editor in relation to the function of the curator is integral to our idea of a civilised culture. It really is. So it must re-erect itself in various forms. If it doesn't, we're in a time of barbarism.
We're just going to have a chat, and then you're going to edit out the best bits. Or, no, you're going to edit in the best bits, I suppose.
You have been listening to a recording